This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's not impossible. We don't believe it's impossible. We believe we've got a task to do and we believe we're going to find the aircraft. We're pretty confident.
BFM 89.9. The gentleman you just heard was Peter Foley. He is the program director for the operational search for MH370 from the Australian Transport Safety Bureau, who are leading the search efforts for the missing plane. This is the evening edition. I'm Uma Pagan Ampake Pagan. 1 year ago, on March the 8th, the Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 disappeared from radar and was never seen again. The last year has seen a tireless international search and locate effort, but one that has thus far brought little news or relief for the families of all the souls on board the missing aircraft. Over the next 2 hours, I will be speaking to a variety of experts in an attempt to ascertain the current state of affairs surrounding the ongoing search for MH370 in conjunction with the anniversary of its disappearance 1 year ago. First up, Peter Foley. He's the man currently overseeing the search and locate operations, the program director for the operational search for MH370 from the Australian Transport Safety Bureau. Mr. Foley, just to start, could you let us know what the current status of the search operation is?
We release an operational update every week, and essentially in that update we talk about where the vessels are and the progress in the search to date. The last one, of course, was released yesterday, and to date we've covered more than 26,000 square kilometres of the seafloor in the search area, in a high priority area. We have, which represents around about more than 40% of the search area covered. We have four vessels in the search area. Up north we have Go Phoenix, which is contracted by DefTech, a Malaysian defence contractor, covering the northern part of the search area. And we have three Fugro vessels working in the southern part of the search area, which is Fugro Discovery, Fugro Supporter and Fugro Equator. Those vessels are contracted to the Australian Transport Safety Bureau and the costs are being shared between the Australian and Malaysian governments. The search to date, we've shown some imagery of the sorts of things that we've been identifying on the seafloor. To date, we have not identified what we consider to be a classification one sonar contact, which are those features on the seafloor that resemble, if you like, an aircraft debris field. So we are finding things, but we, as yet, have not found MH370.
In the last 12 months, has there been anything that you would consider to be a breaking lead in the search for MH370?
In the last 12 months, there's been many leads, including the data that we got indicating the aircraft's track when it was crossing the Malaysian Peninsula and flying up the Straits of Malacca. The work done by the Search Strategy Working Group, which indicates the aircraft's flight path through the analysis of satellite data after that point, is absolutely groundbreaking analysis of something that was never designed to locate or reconstruct the flight path of an aircraft, for example. But, that's the information that we have to hand to indicate where the aircraft flew after it turned at the tip of Sumatra and headed south. And that's the analysis and the information that we're using to define the current search area. So there's been quite a number of things that have guided us over the last 12 months to be searching where we are.
Now, one of the things that we've been reading about throughout the year is that there have been a barrage of new technologies rolled out over the last 12 months in the search for MH370. I was wondering if you could tell us some of these technologies that have been employed and deployed.
Well, as I mentioned, the analysis that was done on the satellite communications data, and there's a very little bit of data which indicates, firstly, where the aircraft had to be on a series of very large arcs, if you like, underneath the footprint of the almost geostationary satellite. So that analysis to tell us where the aircraft was at different times on the arcs is groundbreaking. That's the first time it's ever been used. And further, the analysis of the frequency offset for that communications information also indicates, if you like, with very careful analysis, which has taken quite some time, to indicate to us the relative motion, if you like, between the aircraft and the satellite. So that indicates how the aircraft was flying, what direction it was flying, at various times when it made those satellite transmissions. So in a sense, that is absolutely groundbreaking. It's the first time that analysis has ever been used to reconstruct an aircraft flight path. And the equipment we're using in the search is also cutting-edge technology. The side-scan sonar equipment being used by the Fugro vessels is as good as it gets when it comes to side-scan sonar technology. And the synthetic aperture sonar being used on board Go Phoenix is absolutely cutting-edge. It's the only operational deep-tow SAS system of its kind in the world. So we've looked very carefully at how we were going to conduct the search, how we were going to cover such a big area of the ocean floor very thoroughly, and the sorts of technologies that we'd need to employ to do that. But and we've fortunately had access to the very best, not only equipment, but expertise from around the world.
That was Peter Foley. He is the Program Director of the Operational Search for MH370 from the ATSB. After this, I speak to him about mapping the ocean floor, about how hopeful he is on finding the plane, and just what's next for the search operation. You're listening to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. You're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Umapaga Nampake Pagan. Today on the show, in conjunction with the anniversary of the disappearance of MH370, I'm speaking to a group of experts on the current state of affairs concerning the missing aircraft. Peter Foley is the Program Director for the Operational Search for MH370 from the Australian Transport Safety Bureau. One of the big efforts behind the search for MH370 was to actually map the ocean floor. I think this is the first time such an undertaking has been taken in that part of the world, am I right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Prior to the search for MH370, what we understood of this area of the Indian Ocean in terms of the seafloor topography was very, very limited, and it was limited because of bathymetry, if you like. The mapping data we had was satellite-based, which is indicative only. It's not accurate. So, in a sense, mapping the ocean floor in preparation for the search operation has revealed a lot of things about the seabed that no one was aware of up until now. So it's, of course, data of immense scientific interest, amongst other things, but we obviously needed to do that so that we could safely operate the deep tow systems and the AEV that we're using down there at the moment.
So, Peter, there's a question I'm asking everyone, and I think it's because there is still a general failure of understanding when it comes to the sheer scope of this search. So you still get people saying, oh, well, it's a large plane. How difficult can it be to find? Can you tell us just how difficult it is to find?
It's an extraordinarily large area to search. The definition of the search area doesn't give us a precise location of where to look within a very wide area. If you look at the entire area, it's over 1 million square kilometres, which is enormous. The high priority area of a bit over 60,000 square kilometres is as large as the state of Tasmania in Australia, which is that island down the bottom. It's a very, very large area to search. The scale of the search is, it is the biggest search of all time in terms of looking for a missing aircraft. It's enormous. And the challenges associated with that, with running systems with sufficient resolution to detect what's quite a small aircraft in a very large area, means that we need to cover, we need to search very thoroughly, and it's a very painstaking, methodical process to search little pieces of that area at a time, or long strips actually. The search vessels are actually searching with the tow in very long lines, but it's they're covering a width, if you like, in that line of only 2 kilometres at a time. So it's a very slow and methodical process. There is no quick way to search such a large area for such a relatively small item, even though a 777 you might think is large. Relatively, it's not.
I guess it's been 12 months. What is the current level of frustration with the search teams? I mean, how hopeful are you, are they, about still being able to find something?
There's no frustration. We have always understood the scale of this task was enormous. We set ourselves for a very long search. We thought about all of the things that we'd need to do make it a search that was going to be effective and efficient, if you like, in terms of the resources that we were using. So we set ourselves a very big task, and indeed we're only partway through that. So there's no frustration on the part of the search teams. Everyone in the search teams, whether it's the my team here at the ATSB or it's the teams on board the search vessels, they understand the scale and the importance of what they're doing, and they know that they need to bring the answers. They need to find the aircraft so we can provide the answers, firstly, to the families of these lost souls.
So what's next for the search operations over the next, I guess, just over the next couple of months in the recent future? What do you foresee?
I foresee that we'll continue to make good progress. Weather conditions in the far south, and we're operating as far south as about 39 degrees south on the seventh arc. The weather conditions coming into winter are not going to improve. We'll get more periods of poor weather where search activities will be difficult. So, and we once again we plan for this so that we've ramped up the activities so that we're getting as good a coverage as we can hope for in these better weather months leading into winter. But we'll continue to search hard, and the activities will be very intense up until probably the end of May or thereabouts, but we'll see what happens then. After that point, it's a decision for the Malaysian government, the Chinese government, and the Australian government.
That was Peter Foley. He is the Program Director of the Operational Search for MH370 from the Australian Transport Safety Bureau. Next up, I speak to Bill Palmer. He is an A330 captain for a major American airline. He is also the author of the book Understanding Air France 447. Don't go anywhere. This is the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, this is the Evening Edition, and I'm Umapagan Ampike Pagan. It's been 1 year since the disappearance of MH370, and we are still in the dark as to what happened to the plane and even where it is. It has since become one of aviation's most perplexing mysteries. On the show today, I will be speaking to a series of experts on the enduring mystery of MH370. Bill Palmer is an A330 captain for a major US airline. He is also the author of the book Understanding Air France 447. I asked him just what effect, if any, has MH370 had on his life as a pilot.
Not really much in this case, because we don't really know what happened. In most major accidents, so of course the aviation industry learns a lot from aircraft accidents, continually improving procedures, awareness, and even equipment as time goes on. But since we don't really know what happened here, it's hard to make any changes or assessments based on this particular case, unfortunately.
I guess the one thing that we are kind of questioning constantly, and the question that keeps coming up over and over again, is, of course, in this age, how can an aircraft just disappear? And when it comes to that question, has much been done to maybe improve that situation?
Well, there is some work going on now. I know that there's a group looking at the automatic transmission of certain aircraft data when certain criteria are met. Of course, there's tens of thousands of airplanes in the air all the time, and they constantly transmit data, especially out over oceanic areas where we're only using satellite communication is very difficult, both in terms of cost, because satellite communications is expensive, and also just due to bandwidth. All these airplanes transmitting all this data, the system simply is not set up for that. So what this group has devised is a system that looks for unusual parameters in the airplane to try to detect that something's going wrong now, and then start to transmit at that time. I think their experiments have shown that their algorithm for detecting this is detected just about every, if it had been in place, it would have detected all the incidents, for example, such as Air France 447, or probably the AirAsia flight that we see now, and several other incidents that have occurred over the past years. There are all kinds of schemes out there as far as ejecting recorders and all this kind of stuff. You know, each have its pros and cons, but for anything to be actually put into place, you know, an idea has to be made, has to be proven, developed, accepted as a standard, designed, manufactured, purchased, installed, you know, and put into operation, and all these things. It's a complex process, of course, that takes a lot of time. It's not just like throwing a new radio in your car. It's quite a bit more involved than that, unfortunately.
You're, of course, a practicing pilot, and you're in the industry. And has this kind of freaked you out at all, in the sense that would you like to see certain improvements put into place and almost immediately? What would you like to see happen?
No, I don't feel that way at all. We don't really don't know what happened, so it's hard to, you know, I don't feel nervous about anything. We really don't know what happened. It could have been a fire on board. You know, of course, a lot of people support the terrorist theory. It could have been a meteor hitting the airplane. We really don't know. It's unfortunate that, you know, we haven't been able to find the airplane, but I don't think that's a mystery either, considering the just vastness of the Arabian Sea and all the water out in that general direction and the extreme depth. It's my analogy. It's like sending 4 people on foot to look for a suitcase somewhere in China, and they don't really know what it looks like. You know, it's just, you know, it's just a daunting task. People often say, well, how can you lose a 777? It's so big. But it's a tiny, tiny speck in the scope of the ocean. And, you know, typically when the airplanes hit the water, they're extremely damaged. I mean, you're not going to find, most likely, a 777 floating out in the water, especially with the rough seas. The Air France crash, which occurred in 2009 north of Brazil, the airplane was completely destroyed, you know, laying on the ocean floor, you know, 12,000 feet, you know, 4,000 meters below the surface. They knew where to look, and it took 2 years to find it. The task is just daunting.
I'm speaking to Bill Palmer. He is the author of the book Understanding Air France 447. After this, I ask him just how out of the ordinary it is that 1 year on, nothing has been found in the search for MH370. This is the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. This is the Evening Edition. I'm Uma Pagan Ampike Pagan, and you're listening to our continuing coverage on the disappearance of MH370 in conjunction with its first anniversary. I'm speaking now to Bill Palmer. He is an A330 pilot, and his book, Understanding Air France 447, is a window into just what happened on that ill-fated flight from Rio to Paris. So last year you provided your expert opinion and posited a theory on what you thought happened with MH370. 1 year on, has your opinion changed in any way?
Not really, because I didn't really pretend to know what happened. I am in contact with a gentleman who believes the satellite data indicates that the airplane may not have turned north or south along the arc of the search arc, but probably continued straight toward the Arabian Sea, depending on how you interpret the satellite data. That seemed likely, because it didn't seem to me why the airplane would turn, you know, inexplicably at that point to turn south along that arc. It just didn't seem to make a lot of sense. It would be more likely that it just continued straight on, you know, until it ran out of fuel, assuming that there was no one on board driving things. I don't particularly support the theories. Some are rather extravagant about, you know, hijackers following other aircraft or landing in Russia or whatever. You know, every theory out there has some problem with it. And it's hard to say, but that's my opinion.
Given what you said earlier about how a 777 is a speck in the face of the vastness of the oceans and the world, how out of the ordinary is it then that nothing has been found, not even a seat cushion? I guess in all previous crashes per se, you've always found some sort of debris.
Well, I don't know that any other aircraft that comes to mind other than, for example, Amelia Earhart's aircraft, you know, back in the 30s.
Well, of course, yeah.
Was lost at in such a vast area. It usually happened, you know, somewhere closer to land or overland where it's, you know, easier to locate things. Here we really don't have a clue. Or we have a few clues, but, you know, it's still extremely difficult search. You know, the amount of time and effort it would take to cover the ocean bottom, and considering how small an area they can look at the time it takes to do that, the expense involved, et cetera, it's just, you know, a very, very difficult, expensive, and huge task. You know, it's a shame. You know, we saw satellite images looking down through holes in the clouds, you know, and the sea was so covered with white caps, you couldn't tell anything. I mean, it could have been pieces floating there, but the images weren't of a high enough resolution to be able to tell. So it was just, you know, very, very difficult. In fact, you know, there was in 1950, there was an aircraft lost in Lake Michigan in the United States. That lake's only 900 feet deep at its deepest point. It still haven't found it. So, you know, that's like looking in your bathtub compared to looking in the Indian Ocean for the Malaysia flight.
Is it then a silly question for me to ask you if you're hopeful that any wreckage will be found?
Yeah, I'm hopeful. I'm not sure. It might be a long time. I mean, there could be a sea cushion that washes up on the beaches of Somalia. You know, if someone finds it there, would they recognize it? Would they report it? Or would they just be sleeping on it? I don't know. You know, it's the scale of things is what a lot of people really, I think, don't quite comprehend. And that's the difficult part. You know, it's a 777 is a big airplane to stand next to, but in the scope of the oceans in that part of the world, it's absolutely nothing.
And what do you say to people who have a fear of flying, or, well, particularly a fear of flying Malaysia Airlines?
Well, I don't have any reason to believe that Malaysia is any less safe than any other airline based on these incidents. We don't know. I mean, we don't have the aircraft to find out what happened, so it's hard to say who's to blame, if anyone. So I don't hold Malaysia accountable for it, at least at this time, without any evidence to do it. But aviation airplanes are still incredibly safe. It's the safest form of travel that we know of. It's very, very safe because a lot of people all over the world try very hard every day to keep it safe. And that's part of my job, and that's part of the job of everyone in the industry. That's what we take as our highest priority.
That was Bill Palmer. You can find his fantastic book, Understanding Air France 447, on Amazon.com. After this, I speak to Jesse Walker. He's the books editor at Reason Magazine and the author of The United States of Paranoia, A Conspiracy Theory. I'll be asking him about the prevalence of conspiracy theories and whether or not they have a shelf life. This is the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9. Good evening, I'm Umapagan Ampike Pagan. It's been a year since Malaysia Airlines MH370 vanished. Today, in conjunction with the anniversary of its disappearance, I'm speaking to a variety of experts on the many issues surrounding this enduring mystery. Over the last year, we have seen a lot of material come out, from books to documentaries to op-eds. Some of them attempt to put forward facts, while others posit a range of theories, some plausible, some downright conspiratorial. In fact, you'd be hard-pressed to come across someone on the street who didn't have his own conspiracy theory as to what happened to MH370. But why do such theories endure? Where do they come from, and do they have a shelf life? Jesse Walker is the books editor at Reason Magazine and the author of The United States of Paranoia, A Conspiracy Theory. Last year, I spoke to him about the reasons behind the prevalence of conspiracy theories in the face of national disasters. Today, I'm asking him why they continue to endure. So I was wondering if you could give us a little historical context in that, have you found there to be a shelf life when it comes to conspiracy theories?
It really varies. I mean, the classic example of a conspiracy or set of conspiracy speculations that lasted a long time is the Kennedy assassination. We just hit the 50th anniversary of that, and we've only just seen surveys showing the number of Americans who believe there was a conspiracy dipping below 50%. And still quite a few believing that there was a conspiracy. So that's a much longer lasting than, you know, other cases, and it sort of speaks to, you know, what a long shadow the Kennedy assassination cast over American society. But, you know, in that case, you know, half a century has gone by and it's still out there. Other times it burns out very quickly. People forget that there was any speculation at all. There tends to be people, you know, rediscovering the whole phenomenon of conspiracy theories every few years and forgetting that it was only a short while ago that people were speculating about, you know, say the death of Ron Brown, the Clinton advisor who died in a plane crash and things like that. So it really varies a lot. In the case of the Malaysian planes that disappeared, obviously one thing that could, if they actually find, you know, Flight 370, you'll probably see a burst of speculations based on whatever new evidence appears, you know, at the moment that it disappeared, that it's found. I'm sorry, but after that, though, that sort of lack of an ending to a story is gone, and you'll probably start hearing less of it unless there's some really strange thing, you know, discovered at the bottom of the sea. But it's really hard to predict. It's really hard to judge because you're never quite sure what's going to seize the public imagination and what isn't.
The interesting thing is that with the JFK assassination, there was a lot of official explanations. There was the Warren Commission report. There was so much going on. But in the case of MH370, there's absolutely nothing. Have you found in your research that lack of information or just no information, does that serve as fertile breeding ground for conspiracy, or does that mean people forget about it quicker?
Well, I mean, if the lack of information means people want to fill in the gaps of the data, I mean, if people are interested in the story, the fact that there isn't information available is not going to stop them from speculating. If anything, it'll just, you know, widen the horizons of what you can, you know, reasonably speculate about because you don't know. That's part of the reason why stories like this exist in the first place, is because, you know, we're a pattern-seeking creature, and, you know, any gap in the data, you know, we're going to look for ways to fill it that somehow fit with what we already know, or at least what we already suspect. But in this case, you know, you've got the problem of official stonewalling, and you've got you know, agents of one government accusing another government of hiding the truth, or at least not being very forthcoming with what they know. And, you know, at times like that, you're especially likely to speculate about conspiracies because you've already got this, you know, a reason to suspect that you're being, if not lied to, then at the very least misled or having information withheld. And obviously that makes people extra suspicious.
Now, we're approaching the first anniversary, and of course, there have been a lot of articles that have come out. I think there was a report in GQ. There was an article by Jeff Wise, or a multi-part entry by Jeff Wise, positing different theories that the plane landed in Kazakhstan. I'm going to ask you to put your Psych 101 hat. These kind of speculations, are they healthy?
I mean, there's nothing wrong with, you know, trying to speculate about the answer to a mystery. And, you know, I obviously prefer speculations that are well-grounded to ones that are not. You know, I mean, I don't think it's healthy if someone were to start saying, I think the Jews took the plane or something like that. But certainly, I mean, while the contents of particular speculations might not be good for society, I don't see anything wrong with speculating in the first place. I think it's natural. And I think for the people who are actually affected by it, it's not going to be fun, but it's going to really speak to a need to try to figure out what happened to, you know, people they care about.
That was Jesse Walker. He is the books editor at Reason Magazine and the author of The United States of Paranoia, A Conspiracy Theory. It is a truly fascinating read. Coming up, Roger Rappaport. He is the author of The Rio Paris Crash, Uncovering the Secrets That Changed Aviation History. This is the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Uma Paganampike Pagan. Today, in conjunction with the anniversary of the disappearance of MH370, I'm speaking to a series of experts about the various issues surrounding the missing aircraft. Roger Rappaport is the author of The Rio Paris Crash, Uncovering the Secrets That Changed Aviation History. He writes for the McClatchy Tribune News Service, and his articles have appeared in the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, the Miami Herald, the Atlantic, Harper's, and Esquire. As a widely published travel writer, he has covered the aviation industry for many years. He is also the producer of a brand new film called Pilot Error. Roger, in your book, The Rio Paris Crash, you chronicled in great detail the search for the wreckage of Air France 447, as well as the effect the incident had on the aviation industry as a whole. Can you talk to us a little bit about those changes and how long it took for them to be implemented?
Well, some actually happened before they even found the plane. They immediately began a process of informing the pilots that they needed to follow certain procedures in the event that the plane lost its automation due to icing of the speed instruments known as pitot tubes. In addition, because of a related crash of a plane in Buffalo, New York, they rewrote the stall avoidance procedures and began to train pilots on simulators for some of the problems that were encountered by the French pilots. So there were some immediate impacts. In addition, after the plane was found and they determined the true cause of the accident, that was basically human error induced by machine error, they went ahead and made some modifications to training procedures, which are still ongoing. In addition to that, as a result of some of the International Aviation Transport Industry Associations, they have begun to address the issue of tracking planes over areas where there's no radar coverage, and that's a work in progress. It's going to take many years for the whole system to change, and the reason that that's going more slowly is that no airline unilaterally will make changes to a procedure like tracking planes unless all the other airlines do the same thing, and because of the costs involved, they want to be sure that everybody's bearing the same expense, so nobody wants to step out ahead. And that's a sort of a competitive thing. Unfortunately, the saddest part of the story, which was a factor clearly in the accident of the AirAsia plane, which I know is not the focus of this conversation, but I just want to mention that what triggered the entire incident with Air France was bad weather. And there is definitely a system to help planes navigate around the kind of storm that Air France 447 was in, and also the type of terrible storm that the AirAsia flight was in December. And the point is that over land, there's ground-based radar, so planes can be guided around these terrible storms. But over water, there's no ground-based radar. So they have to rely on a system that uses satellite weather data that's streamed to the planes. And although that technology has actually been in place and proven successful since 2006, 9 years ago, it's still not being implemented. And that's a risk that I think is significant and should be addressed, especially since the technology is readily available.
And I'm assuming the reason the technology hasn't been implemented is also because of cost and competition?
Yeah, cost is often a big factor. I mean, the saddest part of the Air France story is that the government wrote a beautiful report with all sorts of recommendations like the ones we just finished talking about. And the industry, particularly on the tracking thing, you now, of course, see one example. And frankly, it could happen again, because even though the airlines are beginning to improve the tracking, it's still not where it should be, and it's not moving as fast as it should be. Now, there's a reason for that. The reason is that the industry basically is using technology that has worked over time on a big scale. So every accident that happens is treated as a one-off. In other words, that's a reminder of how safe aviation really is. It's the only industry in the world that uses an accident as proof positive that its technology is, in fact, safe. And, in fact, you're very lucky to be able to fly at all on such a safe technology. And why are you complaining? Just because once in a while something goes wrong. That's not a very healthy attitude. And particularly, I feel particularly sorry for the families of the Malaysian victims, because unlike the French victims, they don't know where their loved ones are. And that uncertainty has got to be just a really horrible thing to have to live with. That, you know, in this world where everybody knows what everybody's doing through technology, but you can't find a $200 million airplane, it's pretty sad.
I'm speaking to Roger Rappaport. He is the author of the book, The Rio Paris Crash, Uncovering the Secrets That Changed Aviation History. Coming up, I ask him about the conditions behind the search for Air France 447. This is the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Uma Pagan Ampage Pagan. It has been 1 year since the disappearance of MH370, and today's show has been dedicated to an exploration of the issues surrounding the missing aircraft. I'm speaking now to Roger Rappaport. He is the author of The Rio Paris Crash, Uncovering the Secrets That Changed Aviation History, and the producer of a brand new film called Pilot Error. Speaking of not knowing where things are, I mean, with the Air France plane, I mean, they found a little bit of debris almost immediately, and then it took 2 years
right.
for them to actually get to the black boxes and the rest of the wreckage. Now, can you tell us a little bit about the conditions of that search? Because I think one thing people fail to realize is the scale of the ocean, the scale of the planet. Standing next to a 777 looks huge, but of course it's minuscule in comparison to everything else.
Right, it's like looking for your car keys in the Swiss Alps from 30,000 feet. So, and that's really what they were doing. They were looking down 12,000 feet, trying to find in this area that was, you know, 40 miles by 40 miles, 160 square miles. That's a big area, and just trying to do a search for a plane that's not pinging at all. You know, again, they had the wrong pingers on it. They weren't sending signals to the surface that lasted very long. It's extremely difficult. And the fact that they found it after 22 months, when they had some surface wreckage to go on, shows you just how difficult it is. Now, whether or not they find the Malaysian plane, and I certainly hope they do, has the industry learned its lesson? Well, sort of, but not exactly. And I think that speaks volumes to where the real problem is. Essentially, instead of everybody just saying, look, this is the cost we're going to have to be able to get this right, and we're going to essentially add $10 to the price of every ticket, which is what they could do, they just bury their head in the sand and say, well, we'll commission another study. Now, it is true that they are improving, but they're not improving fast enough. And frankly, it's a voluntary system with a lot of different units of government involved. And here's the saddest thing of all. Malaysia Air is actually a pretty good airline. They had a pretty good safety record. So imagine all the airlines that weren't as good as Air France or as good as Malaysia Air, who are out there, who really they are also have exposure. The whole point of this being that the industry is in this huge battle to keep fares low, that's not really what passengers want. What they really want is a safe airplane. And particularly with all the fuel prices going down, they certainly have the liquidity to address this problem right now if they wanted to.
What do you hope to see as a consequence of MH370? I mean, I know it's difficult because we don't actually know what happened to the plane.
Well, as we point out in our film, Pilot Error, the real solution to this problem is to use this strategy like Air France 447 to make reforms right now. And I think the passengers would go along with it. I mean, who wouldn't get on a plane and pay an extra $10 to know that plane is being tracked right, or that it has radar that can detect horrible storms that are the source of turbulence and potentially could even break up an airplane? I mean, who wouldn't pay an extra $10 for that? It's not like it's going to break the airlines in any way. So the question is, why are they being so stubborn? And I don't know the answer.
More with Roger Rappaport. After this, the one question that has been plaguing our collective discourse. How can a plane just disappear? This is the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Uma Pagan Ampage Pagan. Today, we are commemorating the first anniversary of the disappearance of MH370. We have spent the last 2 hours exploring some of the various issues surrounding the missing plane. I'm speaking now to Roger Rappaport. He is the author of The Rio Paris Crash, Uncovering the Secrets That Changed Aviation History, and the producer of a brand new film called Pilot Error. Tell me, in all of your research and writing, has it brought you any closer to answering the one question, I guess, that's been plaguing this discourse, which is, in the modern age, how can a jet just disappear?
Well, when we did the movie Pilot Error and asked that question, we talked to over 200 pilots when we were doing our research. And the answer is that it can happen, because even though the pilots on that plane didn't make a single mistake in the entire 3.5 hours the flight was flying, the second they lost their automation, they were in a never-never land, because they were flying not only at an area of cruise where they normally don't fly the plane, they actually are banned. They're banned by their airline from flying and flying planes over 29,000 feet. And that's because the separations have been reduced over the ocean to crowd in more airplanes into the same space, so that the industry doesn't want pilots flying airplanes at cruise altitude at all. So that's kind of a double whammy. On the one hand, they don't train them. On the other hand, they tell them you can be written up and sanctioned for that. So unfortunately, that was kind of the prequel to this question, you know, to the question you're asking, is how can it disappear? Well, it can disappear because essentially, when you combine that problem with the fact that pilots aren't flying at the altitude that more than 90% of this particular flight was at, which is cruise, and the fact that the tracking system is basically in the dark ages on this plane. I mean, the technology is just not kept up. I mean, to put the right kind of tracking system on the plane, like the Malaysian one or the Air France, would have cost less than $1 million, probably less than $500,000 per aircraft. There have been some numbers have been thrown out, even as low as $100,000. But whatever it is, with the satellite time involved, there's no excuse. There's no excuse whatsoever.
Where do you stand with regards to the theories? We've seen quite a lot of stuff come out over the last few days in the lead up to the first anniversary, from GQ magazine, the Jeff Wise article. There are all these new theories about what happened to MH370. Are you one for conspiracy, or do you think it was a straightforward accident?
Well, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. There were conspiracy theorists on Air France, too. There were people theorizing that the French government and the French airline didn't want the plane to sound. I never believed that, and I'm not a party. I honestly believe that this plane is in the water. I don't think the people who are on the plane are alive. I don't think there was a conspiracy to take the plane down, and I do think there was an accident that took all those lives, but I think it's premature at this point.
Well, that's interesting, because using the word premature, I mean, you think this is going to be a long one. It's going to be a long search.
I think it's at the bottom. It's in the oceans. I think it's in the water somewhere. The reason that it came down, I think all the theories are really interesting. I do think, based on what happened with Air France, I think it's conceivable that they will find it, but it might take a while longer. I know there's some of the same people that worked on the Air France plane and found it are working on the Malaysian plane. I know some of these guys because I interviewed them for my book and for my movie. And I do think they've got a great team out there. So never underestimate the ability of them to come up with an answer. But I do think that if and when they do find the plane, we may find out that as we found out with Air France, that the various theories that were being thrown around, especially the conspiracy theories, that were getting a lot of traction, turned out not to be quite as accurate. And basically what they found out in Air France was there were many, many different causes for the accident. It wasn't one thing. It wasn't just pilot error. It wasn't just mechanical failure. It wasn't just the weather. There were more than a dozen different things that contributed to that accident. And it took a two-hour movie that we made, Pilot Error, to show some of those causative factors. So I suspect that the crash is going to be attributed to a number of different things going wrong together, not just one thing. I mean, don't you think it's incredible that they had tracking on the engines, but not on the airplane?
Yeah.
They were tracking the engines for performance. I mean, isn't that amazing that the money was being spent to track the engine performance? Same thing with Air France. On that plane, they had all sorts of information about the fact that the bathrooms had lost power, you know, things like that. But they didn't have tracking on the plane itself. You know, they were just basically sending a maintenance log to Paris so that when the plane landed, they could fix all the broken parts. And nobody in the airline got a message that the plane had gone down. I mean, that's pretty pathetic, don't you think? It seems to me that if they're tracking the engines, they ought to be able to track the airplane, right? So why is that? Why weren't they tracking the plane when they were tracking the engines for 8 hours? It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Certainly people in positions of responsibility have lost any credibility that they might have, once we read that. So they had a 7-hour track on the engines, but they didn't know where the plane was. Hard to believe it.
I've been speaking to Roger Rappaport. His brilliant book, The Rio Paris Crash, Uncovering the Secrets That Changed Aviation History, is a must-read for anyone interested in how aviation disasters happen and their enduring impact on the world of commercial flight. You should also check out his new movie. It's called Pilot Error and is available for rental on the Vimeo platform. If you missed any part of this broadcast, you can, as always, download the podcast on bfm.my. This has been part of our ongoing coverage of MH370 on the anniversary of its disappearance. You're listening to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.